This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Borscht Club on ORFM, where we stir up vibrant stories, rich traditions, and the voices of the Ukrainian community. Grab a seat, it's time to dive into something truly special. Welcome back to Borscht Club. Today we continue our conversation with Kirilo Kuche, the author of That Empire Unmasked. In the previous episode, we spoke about Kirilo's book and why Russia's war against Ukraine is not just another distant conflict, but a defining moment for the global order. We talked about how geographic distance no longer protects anyone in 21st century, about the ideology behind the Z symbol, and about why Ukraine's fight matters far beyond its borders. We also discussed Russism as a modern imperial ideology, the role of disinformation in shaping public opinion, and why accepting a so-called peace built on aggression and coercion would set a dangerous precedent for the entire world. So back to our conversation with Kirilo Kuche. And if you missed the first episode, I strongly recommend going back and listening to it. First, I'd like to tell you about a truly exciting initiative, and then we will talk with Kirilo Kuche, the author of Z Empire Unmasked, so don't go anywhere. And now I'm pleased to hand over to the forum organizer, Kate Turska.
In partnership with New Zealand Ukraine Business Association, our Australian counterparts, and supported by organizations across Ukraine, New Zealand, and Australia, we are launching the Australia-New Zealand-Ukraine Cooperation Forum. This is going to be a first-of-its-kind cross-sector event to be held in Lviv, Ukraine, in early March 2026. So the cross-sector forum will bring together leaders from defense, emergency services, business, innovation, philanthropy, and government across ANZ region and Ukraine. And the aim is to build practical two-way cooperation, shape expertise, and explore immediate and long-term opportunities across multiple tracks. For Australian and New Zealand attendees, it offers a unique opportunity for direct access to on-the-ground expertise and meaningful engagement with Ukrainian counterparts and insights into collaboration pathways and know-how.
Well, so the registration is open, yeah?
Yes.
Am I right? And who can register for this forum?
The expressions of interest are open now, absolutely, and we invite anybody to register if you would like to attend the forum, contribute your expertise, explore two-way learning, trade, innovation, or investment links, support event as a sponsor. We are also looking for sponsors to register or help to amplify and share the information through your networks. Generally, our target audience for this forum is Australian New Zealand business leaders, investors, defense stakeholders, emergency response professionals, medical and trauma specialists, philanthropic foundations, tech infrastructure, logistics, and reconstruction companies. So it is a very broad audience. It could also include academics and think tanks, government officials, etc. Because of its core sector nature, it's any company, organization, or individual who is interested to learn how to work with Ukraine, do business in Ukraine, or exchange expertise and knowledge with Ukraine. This forum aims to benefit our region as well as Ukraine. It's not just about, you know, come and help rebuild Ukraine. It is very much about opportunity for Australia and New Zealand as well. So there's a lot of learning that could be had from Ukraine at the moment, and there's a lot of opportunity already in Ukraine when it comes to business, when it comes to management, leadership, crisis management and resilience. All of these areas we would like to explore, and there's absolutely a lot of benefit and a lot of value to be had for Australia and New Zealand attendees. It is a very unique opportunity for them to get a direct access to those on-the-ground expertise in a way that can be done remotely.
Where people can find the information about the forum?
You can head to either New Zealand Ukraine Business Association's website or Mahi for Ukraine website, which is currently ukraine.nz. And there's an expression of interest form, and that contains all the information about the forum. Within the expression of interest form, you can see the event prospectus. You can download it, and it talks about the concept, the timelines, the thematic tracks, the market opportunity, all of the detail. And then also within the same expression of interest form, you can find a sponsor link, sponsor deck as well for those who might want to support event.
So, Kirilo, you trace the same behavioral pattern through Moldova, Georgia, Chechnya, Syria, and now Ukraine almost like a blueprint. What recurring patterns of Russian expansionism does the West still fail to recognize?
Well, frankly, I think that the world sees Russia's strategy much more clearly now than before 2022. But the pattern was there all along for anyone willing to look. The problem is the international community kept treating each crisis on the border of Russia as it were unique. Chechnya, Georgia, even Syria, Ukraine, all seen as separate events. But in reality, they are stages of one long game. A single geostrategy of expansion. This isn't new. Back in 1990s, Jokhar Dudayev, who was elected president of Chechnya, called out Russism and warned that the world was ignoring a dangerous ideology and that it would pay the price for it. And now, 30 years later, the same playbook is still in use and same ideology gained momentum. Every time the West hopes appeasement will buy peace, it never does. And the pattern is consistent. First, tighten economic dependency, flood the information space with confusion, amplify divisions, steer political polarization, claim free speech and human rights abuses, and it's even better if against Russian minorities, then send covert agents, destabilize security in the region or the country, start a conflict, call it internal, and then step in as a convenient mediator to freeze it. Then use peacekeepers as occupiers, hand out Russian passports, strip sovereignty. And if resistance continues, escalate, obliterate cities, kill civilians, and call it valor as in Grozny, Chechnya. But if losing, push for ceasefire, demand concessions, rearm, and invade again. All the while, Russia abuses its security councils, veto power, weaponizes United Nations as an international platform for propaganda, and all along plays the victim, blaming everything on Russophobia. So what does the West still miss? This is not episodic, it is a systemic. Russia has waged an information war globally for decades. It uses military groups like Wagner to project power across continents, and it disregards international law except when it suits its narrative. Again, this is not serious of accidents, it's a strategy.
One of the most accessible sections of your book for a Kiwi audience is your explanation of Russian disinformation. It's frightening how systematic it is. What is reflective control in simple terms, and why is it so effective in democratic societies?
Yes, the interesting characteristic of it is exactly the most effective in democratic societies. So, reflexive control is not just about lying. It's about shaping how people think and react. It works by feeding information that nudges you toward decisions that serves Russia's interest, often without you realizing it. In open societies where debate and tolerance, this kind of manipulation can sow doubt, polarization, and even paralysis. It's a psychological warfare, and it's very effective when people don't know it's happening. And the method is long-term and systematic. It takes root from the Soviet times since 1930s. It plants fake claims inside a pile of truths, often through voices that seem credible, scientists, now influencers, and fake experts. But years later, those planted narratives become evidence for propaganda. In the book, I give an example of a social media account posing as Ukrainian air traffic controller who blamed Kyiv for the downing of the Malaysian passenger plane in 2014. But it turned out to be a Russian paid agent. And I have seen it firsthand too here in New Zealand when in 2022 someone on social media, I just assume a Kiwi, repeated the claims that Ukrainians are all Nazis. And their proof was a quote from former president of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko, allegedly celebrating that children in eastern Ukraine were living in cellars. But the original speech was the opposite. He was condemning Russia for forcing those children into basement by occupying their towns and fueling the war. But the version they shared came from the Russia Today media outlet and selectively edited and mistranslated. And those lies have been exposed by open source intelligence investigations like Blinket and by fact-checking projects such as stopfake.org. But there is a problem. These emotionally charged fakes saturate the informational space. And most people don't check sources. They accept the first thing that fits their bias and share it further. And that's how reflexive control works. It doesn't just misinform. It shapes reaction and reinforces wrong opinions, spreading lies like a wildfire, if you will.
Your chapter on Wagner reads more like organized crime research than military analysis. Why had the world been so slow to recognize Wagner as a tool of state-sponsored terrorism? Are there any other signs that Russia is a terrorist state?
Yeah, great question. So Wagner operated for years in the so-called gray zone, somewhere between private military operations, state warfare and outright terrorism. While Russia as a state denied any responsibility, any linkage to it whatsoever for years. That ambiguity combined with loopholes in international law let it avoid accountability for quite a long time. But if you look at its actions from Syria to Ukraine to Africa, they fit textbook definition of state-sponsored terrorism. Deliberate violence, intimidation, and destabilization for political and even ideological goals. And I elaborate on it in the book, in the chapter you mentioned. After Wagner's atrocity in Ukraine, several countries finally designated it as a terrorist organization formally. But the story didn't end there. Its leadership was eliminated, yes, but the group itself was simply restructured into the so-called Africa Corps, now under direct command of Russia's Ministry of Defense. But according to the open source investigations like molfar.com, there are three dozens of similar Russian private military companies operating in more than 30 countries worldwide. Can you? In regards to other signs of Russia being a terrorist state, it systematically targets civilians. These terror tactics it used in Chechnya, in Syria, and in Ukraine, it openly supports designated terrorist groups internationally, like Hamas and Hezbollah. But the most important point is this. Even without proxies, the Russian state itself acts as a terrorist entity. And terrorism is often dismissed in the context of interstate war. But what Russia does, mass executions, hostage taking, systematic rape, bombing civilian infrastructure, and even nuclear plants, deporting and re-educating children, it's a terrorism. It's not random brutality. It's calculated strategy to break Ukraine's will and force to surrender.
You spend significant time on the early 20th century and Holodomor, topics often erased or misunderstood in the West. Many countries still hesitate to recognize the Holodomor as a genocide, and New Zealand is among them. Why is understanding Ukrainian history essential for understanding the current war?
Because this war isn't an accident or sudden flare-up. it's just the latest chapter in the long history of attempts to erase Ukraine as a nation. So the Holodomor, the man-made famine of 1930s, was an act of genocide, and it happened after the world abandoned Ukraine during the previous Russo-Ukrainian War of 1918-21, that many know about. And think about this, and I know you've touched on similar ideas in previous Borscht Club episodes. We all know about 6 million Jews murdered by the Nazis exactly because Germany was defeated and put on trial. There are Holocaust exhibitions in every major war museum, including here in Auckland. But Russian regimes have never paid for their crimes, never. The world never learned when it mattered the most about the 6 million Ukrainians killed by Moscow during the Holodomor. And most people still don't know today. And New Zealand, by the way, is the only OECD country that still hasn't recognized the Holodomor as a genocide against Ukrainians. But and that matters because millions of Ukrainians who survived were coerced into strengthening Moscow's military. And those troops marched into Europe in 1939. And recognizing that history explains why Ukrainians see this war as accidental, appeasing Moscow or rewarding its crimes doesn't bring peace. It guarantees more violence, and not just for Ukraine, but for the whole world.
You argue that a premature peace or a settlement with Russia equals danger, even genocide. What does a realistic peace look like for Ukraine beyond simply stopping the fighting?
Yeah, I think it's a key question in peace building, is understanding that just peace is not just about the absence of fighting. It means restoring Ukraine's territorial integrity, bringing home deported people, holding perpetrators accountable, and securing real guarantees against future aggression. Anything less just repeats the cycle of violence and betrayal that has marked Ukraine's history with Russia. Long-term peace is only possible if the imperial mindset in Moscow collapses, and that requires consistent and collective international effort. Arming Ukraine, yes, but also isolating Russia and stripping it of the means to wage war. In the book, I ground my vision of peace in Immanuel Kant, in Kantian philosophy, which allies quite closely with how Ukrainians see peace and what Ukrainians themselves want. Peace begins with two principles. First is that the wrong country must be able to defend itself with all means possible and allowed. And second, it must unite with other threatened states against a common aggressor. And that's why alliances matter. And NATO is one option, yes, but there is also the Northern Group of 12 countries around the Baltic and North Seas that clearly recognize the Russian threat and are committed to help aid Ukraine the most and to collective defense. In the book, I even raise the idea of confederation of closely aligned states because strength is in numbers. And ultimately, the goal is to deprive the aggressor of its ability to start wars and guarantee peace through deterrence. And given Russia's presence in the Pacific and its ties to other authoritarian states like North Korea, Iran, and China, this can't just be a European effort. It needs the broadest possible coalition of countries willing to protect peace and the rule of law.
How have drones and emerging technologies fundamentally changed the landscape of modern war?
Yes, exactly. This war is not only about territories, trenches, and tanks. Drones have completely transformed the battlefield. They've become a dominant form of air power. They're cheap, they're fast to produce, and capable of mass semi-autonomous attacks. This changes everything. It disrupts conventional military assets and shifts the balance toward innovative defenders, gives them an edge. Ukraine's large-scale production and use of drones have degraded Russian capabilities and destroyed strategic assets. But unfortunately, there is another side to it, and I talk about this in the book. The exponential rise in drone attacks has also terrorized civilians across thousands of kilometers. And the lesson from Ukraine is clear. Drones are not just a tactical tool. They are redefining modern warfare. They've triggered a new global arms race, I think, and one where swarms of low-cost robots can take out multi-billion dollar aircraft and naval fleets. It forces every military planner to rethink what defense looks like in the 21st century.
Because you live here, you see local reactions firsthand. What is the biggest misconception New Zealanders have about the Russia's war against Ukraine?
It was difficult to select one.
Let's talk about all of them.
Yes. Well, maybe not all of them. It will be too long. But the one I personally hear most often is that NATO expansion somehow threatened Russia and forced Putin's hand. Or maybe another one that Ukraine is just a pawn in American power games. And both ideas are false. The first shows a real misunderstanding of the regional history. And the second, I think, reflects New Zealand's historical wariness of big power dominance, especially by the... And here is the reality. NATO, as an organization, as a defense alliance, was created to protect Europe from Moscow after the Second World War. And after the Soviet collapse, countries that had just escaped the prison of nations, which Soviet Union was, rushed to join NATO. Not because NATO pitched them, but because they knew it was the best way to prevent reinvasion. While Ukraine in the 1990s was a nation which was just reborn, just regained its independence, young independent nation, if you will. And that nation wanted friendly relations with everyone. It gave up its nuclear arsenal in exchange for security assurances from the United States, United Kingdom, and others, including Russia as an aggressor. And Ukrainians thought that was enough. The word of American president document is enough to guarantee, to assure their security, but history proves them wrong. And the idea that Ukraine's civic uprisings in 2004 and then 2013 were American-inspired coups, completely false. Those were grassroots movements. And I personally was proud to be part of the first one. Ukrainians might be even politically apathetic in peacetime, but in crisis, as 2004 and 2013 proved, they always taken their destiny into their own hands, unlike Russians who are blaming everything on the regime and terrible. And well, after everything Ukraine has achieved in 2022 and since 2022, especially while the United States administration turned its back on Ukraine in 2025, I think that only Kremlin agents or the very lazy would claim Ukrainians have no agency without America. Unfortunately, some New Zealanders, sadly, even one I work with, have told me to my face, I don't want this war in my face, and I will never believe what you are saying. And it's sad and short-sighted, I think, especially for people in technologies, because distance doesn't protect us the way it used to. The stakes of this war are global. The future of international law, security and rules-based order, the very things that keep small countries like New Zealand safe.
Your book ends with a challenge to the reader, almost a call to action. If the world could learn just one essential lesson from this war, what should it be?
That complacency is dangerous. Peace and justice don't happen by themselves. They have to be defended, sometimes at great cost, and almost always collectively. Neutrality in the face of aggression is not really neutral. It enables the aggressor. And if that aggression goes unchallenged, the darkness of war and of fascism will eventually reach even the farthest shores.
This conversation with Kirilo Kucha reminds us that wars don't begin overnight, and they don't exist in isolation. They grow out of history, ideology, and the stories societies choose to remember or forget. What happens in Ukraine is not only about Ukraine. It is about what kind of world we allow to exist, and what we are prepared to defend when those rules are broken. Thank you to Kirilo for sharing his insights, and thank you for listening to Borscht Club. If you missed part one of this conversation, go back and catch up. It adds important context to everything we discussed today. We will be back very soon with the next episode. Until then, take care. Слава Україні! Героям слава! Thank you for tuning in to Borscht Club on ORFM. Stay connected with us and listen to our episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts and oar.org.nz. This is your host Оля Вязенко, wishing you joy and a delicious day ahead. До зустрічі! See you next time!
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.